From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. My guest is a well-known environmental activist and a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who over the years has been arrested, praised for his dogged determination, and described as a royal pain in the ass. He's the president of the watchdog group Valley Watch, and most people know him through short video clips and sound bites on the news, but there's much more to learn about my guest, John Blair. So, John, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Well, when did you come to the point in your life, John, when you decided, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore?
Well, it was before the movie Network came out. Actually, I have gotten fired from a number of jobs for speaking my mind. I was generally a civil libertarian, and I really fought for people's rights, whether I had anything to do with it or not. So one time I was working for an organization in Indianapolis, and I lost the job because I found out later that the head of the House Ways and Means Committee was on the board of the company that I was working for, and he didn't like the fact that I was trying to go after property tax relief for renters. So the hearings come and go. I was told I couldn't testify before the House Ways and Means Committee, and I was told that, you're just supposed to stay in your place, do your work. And so I didn't. I abided by that directive. The day the bill passed, I lost my job. And so that really angered me. So I was driving around the circle downtown Indianapolis, and I pulled up on Market Street, and I just sort of stared at the State House for a while. And I made a conscientious decision right there that if I had something to say, I was going to say it. Then I moved to Evansville in 1974. I got a master's degree at Ball State in journalism and moved to Evansville in 74 to teach at the U of E. And I saw that there were some things missing here. And one of those things was anybody being outspoken about the environment. And it was real easy to see that there were environmental issues going on here. In the summer, you couldn't see across this river from where we're at. It was just horrible in 1974. So, and it kept getting worse and worse as these power plants were being built. And of course, the coal industry was devastating the land around here. And so I saw a need to go out and look at that issue independently of everything else. And what I came up with was that there was a health issue connected with all this too. Not only was there an air pollution issue and a water pollution issue from all these coal-burning power plants and plastics and aluminum mills and things like that, but we had a situation where people were dying. And that wasn't in my nature to allow something like that to happen. So I became an environmental health advocate in 1977.
So now you've battled big coal, big chemical, and big power. Did you grow up in a family of activists?
My aunt was a big supporter of the John Birch Society and the Koch brothers on the other end of the spectrum. She taught me that activism was worthwhile, I think, but that was the only connection I had. I've just always felt a need to be a public citizen, and I really don't think that there are very many people who act independently, at least in southwestern Indiana, that are public citizens. Some people come to mind, Richard Lithgow, for instance, who was really a hero of mine, not from so much for what he actually did, but as far as what he accomplished, he accomplished quite a bit. But it was the way he went about it, being so dogged and resistant to the powers that be.
Tell us more about Richard Lithgow for people.
Well, Richard Lithgow was a retired union guy. He had worked for Vectren for SIGECO for a number of years. And when he retired, he had time on his hand, and he decided to start taking on the city of Evansville on some things. He took on the Victory Theater project, for instance, because of the way it was being funded. He didn't like that, and found a way to cause a referendum on it, and the city lost the referendum. So it ended up they had to seek other ways. And then his downfall in in the public eye was when he took on the new airport terminal and delayed it for a couple of years, actually. And like I said, I wasn't against the new airport terminal. I remember the old one. But I did believe that Richard used his power as an individual to try to do everything he could in that power to make change. And I had just a huge admiration for that.
Mm-hmm. I found out that John Blair of Virginia was one of the signers of the U.S. Constitution, which defends the rights of free speech and free press. I found that ironic since you're a champion of both of those. And he became a Supreme Court justice. So maybe some genetics there, John. I don't know.
Well, I've always found it fascinating that no matter what I might do, I won't be number one on Google.
That's true. Now, you were born, I found out, in Winchester, Indiana. That's the home of Wick's Pies.
Yes.
Famous Wick's Pies. Indiana State Pie is a sugar cream pie, I believe.
They're delicious.
So tell us about Winchester.
I don't know much about Winchester. I ended up in under an oxygen tent in Winchester, Indiana, when I was 2 years old because of asthma conditions. And I remember when we finally moved from Winchester that my dad's asthma and my asthma both went away. So there was something, you know, I didn't think about this until years later, but there was something environmental that was clearly causing that asthma. And, you know, I have thought about that a lot since then because, you know, environmental conditions do cause suffering and illness for people.
Now, you make a living being a photographer. So how did you
meager as it is.
So how did you get hooked on taking pictures?
Well, I used to be a mortgage banker in Indianapolis. I financed shopping centers and apartment complexes for what was called American Fletcher Mortgage Company. And they had a camera that I would shoot tax comparable properties with. And I started taking that camera home on the weekends and shooting people and events and things like that, and found a real love for being able to create these images. And so one thing led to another. I bought my first camera. Interestingly, I bought my first camera in August of 1970. And I went out with it on my shoulder, went out, and lo and behold, this woman kind of trips in front of me on Pennsylvania and Market Street in Indianapolis at lunchtime. And I ask her if I can help her, and she says, okay, and we start talking. We ended up going to lunch. She was soon to be Mary Blair about a year and a half later. So she was also my first subject the next day. And, you know, I photographed her, and I find that kind of interesting.
You know? Well, did you photograph her with a broken ankle or something, or what?
No. She survived that stumble pretty well.
Okay, so my guest is environmental activist John Blair, president of Valley Watch, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. So let's talk about that photo, seen around the world, taken in Indianapolis in 1977. Anthony Caritsas, he was a real estate developer, and he was an angry man.
Yes, I don't know what to believe in all that, because on my way to Indianapolis, I was what was called a stringer for United Press International. And on my way to Indianapolis, the next day after he kidnapped this guy, Richard Hall was the kidnappee, ran a mortgage company called Meridian Mortgage. And people were calling in saying, oh, Meridian Mortgage ripped me off too. And so I heard all these stories going up there on WIBC. And I didn't know what to believe with that either, because, you know, Tony was clearly nuts. On the night that he gave himself up, where I shot the picture, the last thing I remember him saying was, I'm a national hero and don't you forget it. And from that point on, I really was on autopilot because, you know, just shooting, because I knew I was dealing with kind of a crazy situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the photo shows Caritsas with a sawed-off shotgun.
It's not sawed-off. Oh, it's a pistol shotgun, 12-gauge pistol shotgun.
Anyway, it's attached to this guy's neck.
and the trigger's attached to Kritsis's neck.
Yeah, and it's what's called a dead man's line.
That's what's been referred to, yes.
Yes, okay. So if somebody, if the cop shot him, it would go off and kill the hostage. So anyway, you took a picture of this apparatus tied to this guy's neck.
Yeah, it was a high drama evening for sure. I got back to my office or to the UPI office and called my wife up. I said, well, I think my life has changed. But I did not understand how much it possibly could change because, you know, later on it was the picture was awarded a Pulitzer Prize, but it was awarded to the bureau manager at UPI who had taken credit for it that night. And we had argued about it that night. I said, that's my picture, Jim. And he said, well, we got to get it out. We got to beat AP. And I agreed with that, so we got it out. His initials were on it, and his name was on the picture. So, you know, we went over it the next day when we went out to the apartment complex again to pick up our stuff that we'd left behind. And, you know, he agreed that it was my picture, I thought. But then I was on vacation in April of 1978, when the Pulitzers were awarded, and I remember going down the street. I was down in Fort Lauderdale when Mary and I were going down to the beach, and radio came on, says the Pulitzer Prizes were awarded today, and I looked over at her and I said, well, there'll be other years. I mean, you know, I was saddened because I didn't think that picture had been entered into the contest. And lo and behold, it had. UPI had entered it into the contest and it won. So,
yeah. But you took the actual picture.
Oh, yeah. It was clearly my picture. And,
right.
I was able to prove that. In fact, I had to fly back from Fort Lauderdale to meet the president of UPI Pictures and the business manager for UPI in Indianapolis and Jim. And it was determined in that meeting that I shot the picture.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the prize itself. Is it a certificate? Is it a trophy? What is it?
It looks like a college diploma. It comes in a fold-up thing like a college diploma does. Mm-hmm. Came with a $1,000 check in 1978. I don't know when they changed, but I heard it was a $15,000 award now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'd like to win another one.
So how did that prize affect your career?
Well, it had positive and negative impacts. You know, it gave me a lot of independence. I knew I could probably go someplace else and get a job. And so I had just started, 1977 was when I started doing my environmental work. And then in 1978, I won this prize. So I thought, somewhat correctly, that I could say what was on my mind and know if I got run out of town, I'd have someplace to go. Mm-hmm. So I started speaking my mind and on environmental health issues, and I've been pretty consistent on that over the last 40 years. It's kind of sad that in Evansville, I've always perceived Evansville as a place that you're really not supposed to have an opinion. And if you do, you should probably keep it to yourself or you'll be held up to public ridicule. I remember one time I was running for office. Excuse me, I've got the Evansville cred. I was running for, I can't remember, I've run for office three times and lost all three times.
You ran for a school board once, didn't you?
That was the last time in 1996. And Dennis Avery, who's a dear friend of mine, told me, he says, you know, John, I've never met anybody that was hated more than you are. And I've never understood that because all I've ever tried to do is protect people's health. And it's really strange to be put in a position where people hate you and you can't earn a living in your hometown because people hate you because you try to protect their health. That is bizarre to me.
Well, now, coming up, got John fired up here. John Blair's advice on successful disobedience, his arrests for disorderly conduct, and how a federal judge defended his right to free speech. Also, John's thoughts on climate change and an unlikely friendship with the head of a major power company. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.
Support for 2 Main Street with David James comes from listeners like you and from Evansville Regional Airport, hundreds of one-stop worldwide destinations on 3 major airlines to 5 hubs, and nonstops to Orlando on Allegiant. More at flyevv.com.
Two Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. You're listening to 88.3 WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, Owensboro. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and my guest is the president of Evansville-based Valley Watch, John Blair, who is also an educator and Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. And when we last talked to John before the break, John was fired up about being the most hated man in the tri-state, and all you want to do is protect people, John.
I don't understand
it. That's a conundrum for you, right?
It is, and it has been. Doing this for 40 years now, I've never quite understood. We made a very conscious decision back in 1979 when we formed Valley Watch. We didn't actually become an official organization until 81, but our thinking was going on in 79. We made a very conscious decision to put public health. Our purpose is to protect the public health and environment of the Lower Ohio River Valley, which we define loosely as someplace this side of Louisville and someplace this side of the mouth of the Ohio into the Mississippi. So we made a very conscious decision that health would be our main issue. And it was based on things that both my friend Tom Zeller, who helped found Valley Watch, and myself had heard when we were kids that if you have your health, you're wealthy. And, you know, I thought that probably would mean something, but, you know, health is not on people's agenda around here. That's why we have this designation every so often of being one of the fattest cities in the nation. And you know, we have a lot of smokers here. And I mean, health is not on people's minds around here. I wonder sometimes if all the pollution that we have to endure isn't affecting our brains somewhat.
Now, of course, you know it makes a good photograph, composition, lighting, subject, and action, and you know what makes good news footage. So as part of your civil disobedience campaign, John, there was a well-staged event in 1985 in Western Kentucky. This is when you stole some gold-plated shovels that were to be used in a groundbreaking. And so you'd planned this.
Well, actually, the plan was very different than what we ended up executing. The plan, I had four, I'll refer to them as little old ladies in army fatigues, getting out of a car that I was going to drive. And they were going to get out in their army fatigues and go pick up the shovels and come back. And then we were going to deposit them at the Audubon Park Museum. We thought that John James Audubon would be really proud of us.
Now, this was a groundbreaking for what?
It was Union Carbide wanted to do a PCB removal facility in Henderson, Kentucky. And the people of Henderson in general were opening their arms to them. There's going to be 30 jobs. And you know, it was also going to open the whole region up to being a center of the hazardous waste industry. And I saw the ignorance in that. So the night before the hearing, or I'm sorry, the night before the groundbreaking, mm-hmm. I called these women up and every one of them had to get their hair fixed the next morning. It was so strange. So I thought, this is too good an idea to let pass. So I quickly called a friend of mine who had a pickup truck, and she said that she would drive the pickup truck and we'd go through the plan, but I'd have to get the shovels. And so we carried that out, and I let all the media know in advance that it was in their interest to be there for that groundbreaking. And of course, it was pretty big news, all had been for several months before that. And so we did that. I remember the news director for Channel 25 told a friend of mine, says, "That John Blair, that sure is good TV." And then a guy who used to be an anchor in this building, a guy named Paul Morrison, wrote a song about it called "The Ballad of John Blair," and put all this music to this.
I've seen it. It's very clever.
It is interesting,
And it's on YouTube.
Yeah, I put it up on YouTube. I guess it's been 2 years ago. I don't know how many views it's had.
Now, but you were arrested.
Yeah, I was tackled with the shovels, and it was good TV.
Who tackled you?
I guess they were sheriff's department people. The uniform guy had a brown uniform on, I know, and the other guy was in plain clothes. I'm not sure if he was a sheriff's department or Henderson Police Department, but I bypassed the original plan because I heard their footsteps right in back of me, and I thought, what if one of these guys thinks he's Clint Eastwood, and we take off and he starts firing his gun at us. So I just kept running by the pickup truck and ended up getting tackled. I'm not a very quick, fleet runner. Running's not my deal at all.
Well, you weren't planning on escaping with those shovels anyway. You probably knew you would be apprehended, didn't
Well,
you?
No, actually, the original plan was I was going to dump them in that pickup truck and get in the car, and we were going to go to the Audubon Park Museum and leave them on their doorstep.
Like Bonnie and Clyde, you're just going to speed away. And
that's right.
Wow, but you didn't quite complete that mission.
Well, as soon as I heard those guys on my tail, I thought this isn't going the way we planned. So I just kept running, but that was I'm a little surprised that hasn't been emulated somehow, because it was very symbolic. We were trying to stop construction. That it showed that it was active versus passive civil disobedience, which is something that I definitely advocate. And it was easy for people to understand, and see. It made good TV, for instance. And I think that those are the criteria that you need to use. Obviously, nonviolence with any civil disobedience act, but. Civil disobedience has long been in our, the American Revolution started with an act of civil disobedience. And, now there was a law passed in Indiana last year. I think it was passed in Indiana last year. It's up in Kentucky now. Jim Gooch just introduced a bill to, if you do anything that's civilly disobedient and say Valley Watch would put it on their Facebook page that something was going to take place, that you ought to attend this rally or whatever. And then if there's violence, if Valley Watch put that on their Facebook page, we could be held liable by prosecution.
For inciting violence?
For some kind of nebulous, made-up charge that we didn't have anything to do with. I don't think that law will be found to be constitutional. But, if it is... this country's gone straight down, and we've lost our rights entirely.
Now, you spent a night in jail or a day in jail?
I spent probably 15 minutes. I had arranged, had my bail paid.
Okay.
And, so that was done pretty quickly. So I wasn't in the Henderson County Detention Center very long at that point, but I did have to appear before a judge. I was charged with disorderly conduct. The prosecutor pretty much asked me what I wanted, and I said, "Well, I think a night in jail and a $100 fine." I got a $150 fine and a night in jail by a judge they called Hanging Harvey. So I, that was the only time I've ever been in jail overnight, and it was I don't want to go back, but it's price you pay if you're going to stand up for your rights. I was in jail another time here in Evansville, too. I went to Dick Cheney's rally for John Hostetler at the Civic Center. And
Dick Cheney, the vice president?
Yeah.
Cheney?
And I was I was standing on the town square where the Civic Center is, and he was across in Vandenberg Auditorium. And I held a sign up that said, Cheney, 19th century energy man. And I got arrested. And
is that all you did, just held the sign up?
That's all I did. I got arrested. And Cheney, this was the first time he had been out of D.C. at any public kind of event after 9/11. So there was extra security. So, and I remember the cops that arrested me, one of them was a former student at the U of E. They were saying, well, what are we charging him with? And I said, exercising my rights as a citizen of the United States, I guess. And so they charged me with disorderly conduct. I go into court the next morning. I was in jail for 2 hours, I guess. Had to watch this guy sleep off a drunk. I was pretty secure in there. I wasn't treated badly or anything. Paid my bail and had to appear in court the next morning. And clerk comes out and says, hey, we need to talk. And she said that Stan Lefko had upped the charges from disorderly conduct to resisting law enforcement. And, you know, I'll admit that I might have resisted law enforcement verbally. I might have said, what right do you have to tell me that I cannot stand here with my sign? And, I mean, if that's resistance, again, we're in trouble as a nation. You know, resisting law enforcement's a serious crime, and you can be put in jail for a long time. So I was a little surprised that Stan Lefko, who was a Democrat, would do something like that. Well, he ended up, it was an interesting story, because he ended up dropping the charges after I said, you know, he offered to drop the charges if I would commit to not suing the city for my arrest. And so I had an attorney that was working with me, and he called me up and says, Stan's made this offer. And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I think you ought to take it. And I said, well, let me sleep on it. So the next morning I got up and I thought, I know what I'm going to do. And I called my attorney and I said, well, the way I see it, I had to give up my rights as a citizen of the United States and get arrested. And now the prosecutor's asking me to give up another right of suing the people who arrested me falsely. And I said, just tell him to stick it where the sun don't shine. And so he dropped the charges about 2 weeks later. And lo and behold, I hadn't even thought about suing the city. Maybe Stan Gade did me a favor by making that offer, because I sued the city. The American Civil Liberties Union defended me, and we won a pretty good settlement that is a substantial part of my retirement income, actually.
Now,
I won on First and Fourth Amendment grounds, by the way. Mm-hmm. I won on First Amendment grounds because I was exercising my First Amendment rights, and I won on Fourth Amendment grounds because of illegal arrest. Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand there was another arrest in Washington, D.C.
We went there to be arrested. That was my purpose of going there, at the Capitol Hill Power Plant in 2009. But it didn't happen. I stood there with leaders from across the world. James Hansen, the climate scientist that's so famous, and Bill McKibben, who's the author who's done so much on climate, and Wendell Berry down in Kentucky, the poet laureate of Kentucky and wonderful author. There were a number of us that were out there willing to be arrested, and the Capitol Hill police decided to let us go, just let us have our protest.
Well, okay, there you go. Now, you also talked about the 3 points of civil disobedience. First of all, being nonviolence.
Nonviolence, the most important one, of course.
And then active versus passive. Explain that.
Well, what I did with stealing those shovels was obviously an active move. It wasn't climbing across a fence and sitting down and being drug off. It was an active thing. So doing civil disobedience in a passive way certainly shows a commitment on the part of the person getting arrested, because getting arrested is no fun. And I think that most people recognize that. And in D.C., a lot of times people get arrested and they're released and nothing ever happens. In Evansville or Henderson, Kentucky, or places like that, you know, there's consequences to pay for being arrested. And, you know, unless you do something really heinous, and then maybe you won't be arrested. But
and then the other point is symbolism.
The symbolic nature of civil disobedience is very important because people have to clearly understand why you're doing what you're doing. You know, just climbing across a fence, getting arrested, or stealing the shovels or whatever, if people don't understand the motivation behind that, you know, then you've done it for naught. What I'm concerned with more than anything else right now, David, is that I'm not sure that in today's media world that if you did something that was civilly disobedient in Evansville, that it'd even get covered. You know, and clearly coverage, media coverage, is important to the exercising that symbolic nature of what you're trying to do. If it doesn't get covered, there's no purpose done in allowing yourself to go through that headache.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've, of course, challenged a lot of projects that you decried as being harmful to the health and safety of this region. And tell us about Marble Hill, the nuclear power plant in southeastern Indiana, right?
Yeah, near Madison. It's actually closer to Hanover, but it was in Washington. I think it was near New Washington, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Marble Hill was a 2,230 megawatt nuclear power reactor that was proposed in 1973 at a cost of $700 million. By the time we went through the hearing in 77, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearing, the price had risen to $1.4 billion. By the time that Governor Orr, very wisely in 1984, said, we're not going to allow you to recover cost on this plant, the price that they had already paid was $2.8 billion, and it was only 20% complete. So it would have been just a horrible economic disaster for the state of Indiana. And it came, of course, right on the heels. They started construction in late 77, and it was in March of 79 when the Three Mile Island accident occurred. So they had that going against them, too. And then later in the early 80s, interestingly, when Joel Deckard was pursuing this matter, too, as our congressman, Joel was on the board of Valley Watch, by the way, one of the original board members of Valley Watch. When they were looking at the whole thing in early 1982, there was these construction flaws that were found because they were trying to cut corners, and there was big voids in the concrete containment buildings around the reactors. And then when that was revealed, you know, that was pretty much the icing on the cake of all the cost overruns that had occurred and everything, and it was kind of doomed from the start, like the whole nuclear industry has been doomed from the start. You know, they claim to have a good record, but there's been so many near misses, and then you have, of course, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima is not over yet. You know, we're still dealing with that, and I don't know if any of the fish, and this is kind of a bold statement, but I'm not sure that fish from the Pacific Ocean will be worthy of our consumption in another 15 years if they keep releasing radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima. So, oh yeah, nuclear is really safe and it's affordable. Nuclear energy was said to be so cheap it wouldn't even have to be metered. Ha, ha, ha. You know, the Vogtle nuclear plant that's being built as the new way to do it in Georgia, you know, has over $8 billion of federal loan guarantees. Hmm. Most expensive electricity on Earth if it's ever completed.
Now, Marble Hill, the site itself now is kind of a ghost town, really.
Yeah, there's
not
big
much towers
left.
And
there's not much left. It's all been pretty much taken down now.
Mm-hmm.
It was abandoned, and much of the equipment was sold off. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I think they took the last of the structures down.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk to John Blair, my guest, the president of Valley Watch and Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. We're going to talk about John's unlikely bond with the former head of a major power company and the goals that they shared, and John Blair's family, his wife Mary, her work with the Tri-State Food Bank, very rewarding, I'm sure, and the inspiration he receives from his daughter. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Evansville Regional Airport.
Support for 2 Main Street with David James comes from listeners like you and from Evansville Regional Airport, hundreds of one-stop worldwide destinations on 3 major airlines to 5 hubs, and non-stops to Orlando on Allegiant. More at flyevv.com.
Two Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. You're listening to 88.3 WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, Owensboro. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and if you're just joining us, my guest is local environmentalist and president of Valley Watch, John Blair. John, okay, the debate over climate change, fact or fiction?
Well, it's sad that you have to ask that question because it's so clear. It's September 10th, and it's going to be 95 degrees in Evansville, and that's going to be really common. Purdue University just recently found that they projected out that if we go business as usual, that we will have in Evansville, in Vandenberg County, that we will have 90 days of 95 degree weather by the year 2080. Now think about that. That will be devastating. It'll be devastating to our farmers. It'll be devastating to our gardens. It will be devastating to our health. Everybody that sweats will hate it. You know, it's there, and it's coming. It's getting worse. I think we've already reached a number of tipping points. You know, the Arctic was on fire at the same time the Amazon was on fire. You know, how can people say this isn't an issue? It's like, greed is driving ignorance, and ignorance is going to cause us to probably eliminate our species on this earth.
Now, climate change, of course, is a big hot issue in Congress.
Hot.
Hot issue. There we go. In Congress, a lot of debate over that. Is greed driving this? Is the money?
I don't know what else it could be. It seems that, to me that it's people who own coals, greed to want to sell more coal. It's people who burn coals, greed to say, well, you know, if we can just get rid of these nasty environmental regulations, we'll be okay. We'll, you know, so already people of southwestern Indiana, we live in right here in Evansville, we live in the center of the largest concentration of coal-fired power plants in the Western Hemisphere, if not the world. I suspect there may be another area in China that is worse than Evansville, but we have 15,103 megawatts of coal-fired power surrounding us for the last 40 years. 15,000 megawatts. Vectren's part of that has been around 2,000 megawatts. All the rest of it we ship out of the area so that other people can flip the switch without thinking what they're doing to our health. You know, and coal, you destroy the ecosystems by mining it, then you take it and burn it and pollute the air and the water horribly, and then you have this waste material that is poisonous as well that we just conveniently want to leave behind. It's the worst possible thing to do. And interestingly, you know, when I first started looking at coal after I moved here in 74, you know, there were power plants in every community, almost. Up around Pittsburgh, the power plants were 300 megawatts. Down the river, they started growing and became 1,000 megawatts. By the time they got to this region, we have a 2,600 megawatt plant in Rockport, a 3,340 megawatt plant in near Princeton in Gibson County. We have a 2,000 megawatt plant in Petersburg. We have a 2,650 megawatt plant, it's no longer that, down in Central City or Paradise of all names. And then the Sebree plant is 1,800, 1,900 megawatts. We have these giant coal-fired electric plants surrounding us. And, yeah, you know, I was ignorant, too. I didn't realize what coal was doing to us. And I was always a proponent of clean coal for the first 20 years, or at least 15 years of my environmental activity, until I realized that you had all these issues, the waste, the mining, the burning, you know, were all important issues.
Okay, let's get a note of optimism here, John. Coal mines are closing. We've seen several of those close recently.
Recently.
Now, are we finally getting this shift to more sustainable energy, solar, power, wind power?
Absolutely. I mean, the capital system is certainly recognizing the need to shift. And, you know, it's too bad our government doesn't recognize that need. They're, you know, early on, you know, solar was given these tax credits and things like that. People had put it on their roof. They'd get a 30% tax credit and then net metering and that sort of thing. But the state of Indiana has gone the other way. They want to take all that back, you know, so that they can keep the coal industry in. And frankly, the coal industry is not a very big industry in Indiana, certainly not in the United States any longer. You know, I feel sorry for those coal miners that lose their jobs unless they have fought everything they can to keep their jobs as legacy jobs into the future. When people come up and complain to me because I'm ruining their job, I ask them, well, how many blacksmiths do you think we should have working in the United States today? You know, should we have all those blacksmiths that were employed back in the early 1900s just because they had jobs and they should be able to keep those jobs? You know, you've got to progress. And eliminating fossil fuels from our mix is progress. You know, whether you call yourself a progressive or a conservative, it's progress. And I'd like to remind people that the root word of conservative is conserve. Why do you suppose that word grew? Is because, you know, people need to conserve. We need to conserve our resources. We need to conserve our money. We subsidize the fossil fuel industry hugely. And it's wrong. I mean, it's just plain wrong. We already subsidize the fossil fuel industry with our health. Why should we subsidize them any further?
Now, okay, let's go to your productive relationship, in quotes, with Neil Ellerbrook, the former CEO of Vectren. That's an interesting relationship. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I had never met Neil. He's until Alcoa announced that they were putting scrubbers on Warrick Power Plant. And so Alcoa invited me out there for that. I guess it's kind of, you know, window dressing to have the environmentalists there.
So you're the token environmentalist?
I guess. I don't know. I didn't see anybody else there that would be called that. But I saw Neil get out of the car, and I saw he was having a little issue with his physical aspect of things. And he walked on under this tent, was by himself, and I thought, well, this is an opportunity for me to say hello and introduce myself. So I went over to him, and you know, I've always been direct. We got to talking a little bit, and I said, you know, we ought to sit down and talk about the environment some. And he said he agreed with that. Well, in the meantime, Vectren had announced that they were 20% owners in the Edwardsport Power Plant with Duke Energy, a fiasco from the word go. At the time, they were going around getting their political support for it in 2004 or so. The cost of that plant was $1.2 billion, I believe, and it was for 630 megawatts of electricity, gasified coal producing the gas would produce the electricity. And by the time we went through the IURC, Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, hearing in 2007, the cost had risen to $1.985 billion. And so anyway, this was in December of 2006 that I sat down with Mr. Elderbrook and discussed Vectren's future. And my contention was that them being a 20% owner of this plant could well cause them to go into bankruptcy. And he listened. And at that point, by the way, they had decided very shortly after our original meetings to drop out of the Edwardsport Power Plant, which was a wise decision on their part. And I'm proud of the role that I played in that. This Leucadia thing, Leucadia owned Indiana Gasification. Vectren didn't want to have to buy synthetic gas from them, and the state of Indiana had passed this law requiring Indiana commercial and residential gas customers to buy the output of this plant. The state was going to buy it, and then we had to buy it from the state. I call that the communist Chinese model of business, and went very close to that kind of model of business. The state owned it. You know, they were going to supply all the money to Indiana Gasification. It was a ludicrous deal. And I knew then, as I did when I talked about Edwardsport to Mr. Elderbrook, that it was a mistake, and it would end up costing far more than the $2.8 billion. And so I fought that. We were meeting with him and Ron Christian and some of my colleagues at the Vectren office in Indianapolis. And Neil called me and said, "You want to go up on our plane?" And instead of driving up, "Sure, I'll save my gas." So we went up there on the plane and you know, we had some interesting conversations about economics and different things about that. And on the way after our meeting, we were aligned on Indiana Gasification at the time. We were allies. So we got back to the airport after this meeting, and Peyton Manning happened to be standing next to his jet right next to the Vectren plane in that field-based operation. And so Vectren sponsored the Colts games on the radio. It was a Vectren radio network. And so Neil gets out of the car and, Peyton, it's Neil Elderbrook. And so Peyton comes over and I got to shake his hand and they're talking, and I did a little video and some stills of Neil and Peyton together and which I shared with him later. And so on the way back, real interesting conversation took place. He says, "Well, what do you think about his salary?" Referring to Manning. And I said, "Well, it seems to me," I can't remember what it was at the time. This was in 2007, 2008. It was at least $16 million is what I have in my mind anyway, from the Colts alone, let alone the endorsements. And I said, "Well, in my mind, you know, he puts his life on the line for at least 16 weeks a year, every Sunday." And I said, "You know, that seems to me like a real market-driven amount of money." I said, "I resent his salary a whole lot less than I resent your salary being the CEO of a monopoly that's guaranteed a profit." You know, and at that time, I think he was making around $5.5 or $6 million a year. And then you know, he said, "Well, I said, although I did notice from the annual report this year that you took a little cut in salary in whatever year it was." And he said, "Well, whatever it is, it's huge," and which I thought was kind of funny. And
well, before we go on, I want you to talk about your family. Now, your wife, Mary, she was the executive director of the Tri-State Food Bank for what, 17 years or
it
something?
It was a
like
long
that?
Time. I can't remember exactly how long she took over for Phil Hoy when he retired.
Yeah. And you have two adult children now, Will and Stephanie.
That's correct.
And now Stephanie was born with Down syndrome.
That's correct, 1980. She'll and be 40 next year.
She is working, and apparently you have said she's taught you tolerance, John.
Well, you know, she... You know, it's easy for people to look down on people who aren't as mentally acute as or aware as somebody perceives themselves to be. And so you have these bullying tactics and things like that. Well, Stephanie's always stood up for herself. I think she gets a little of that from both her mom and her dad. And you know, Steph has been a real jewel over the years. She still lives at home. She seems as happy as anybody can possibly be. She's a jewel. My son just moved back here from Colorado. He's going back to school at Ivy Tech and intends to be there for a couple of years. And then he hopes to go back to Colorado where the humidity is not quite so bad. He hates the humidity here and is... We see it's we're all going to suffer. We're taping here in September, and so you know it's tough on him. He doesn't like it here, and you know I understand it. This is an oppressive environment for days at a time in the summer.
Well, I know Valley Watch is continuing to grow. I know you have an active website. And you're always attending meetings and keeping an eye on the environment. And I just want to keep you, I just want to let you know that we thank you for sharing your passion to protect the air we breathe and the water we drink. And I know you have your critics, but you want to ensure a healthier future for not only the folks living now, but for the next generation. And I know that's the Valley Watch mission. And Keep on trucking, John Blair.
Well, thanks, David. I certainly intend to. You know, I can't imagine retirement, frankly. Mm-hmm. I guess you can't either.
Yeah, we like to be busy, don't we? John Blair, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street. And I am David James. And 2 Main Street is presented by Evansville Regional Airport. A couple of footnotes to the John Blair interview. John told me he was a veteran stockholder and attended the stockholder meetings. And in the federal case, Blair versus the city of Evansville, the city argued Blair violated a public safety order when he didn't move to a designated protest area. The judge granted, in part, Blair's motion for a summary judgment. All charges against Blair were dismissed.